Sebastian Copeland, who's both a photographer and a polar explorer, has witnessed the drastic effects of climate change firsthand during his extensive travels above the Arctic Circle. For a new book called Arctica, The Vanishing North, Mr. Copeland has turned his lens toward the flora and fauna of the Arctic North to both reveal the region's extreme beauty and to shed light on the effect that climate change is having on one of the world's most fragile ecosystems. His collection of images is published by Tenoyes, and I'm very pleased that it brings Sebastian Copeland back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you, Leonard. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you first come to visit the Arctic?
You know, the Arctic was, it's been a long-coming relationship. That was, the seed was planted in childhood with tales of, Jack London was one of my favorite writers, so I read, you know, The Call of the Wild.
All mushy huskies.
Well, it is, but it definitely is the call of the wild and those far regions, northern latitudes and whatnot. So, and then beyond that, I ended up reading tales of early explorers, Nansen and Perry, and then, of course, the southern end of it in Antarctica.
So. Well, there are a number of tragic situations. You mentioned Perry. I imagine that long stays in the Arctic could make you feel rather isolated.
That's the beauty of it.
You like that?
Well, it's just nice to get away from the scrum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's here we are in New York City, and it's vibrant and eclectic and dynamic, but it's also overbearing and suffocating. So, and I feel the same about the digital world. You know, you've sort of bombarded with communications, and sometimes it's more confusing than enlightening. So getting out there is, I think, a way to get reconnected to something that is deep within us.
When people think of the Arctic, they're likely to imagine a world of white and gray, and there are a fair number of images in this book that are in that kind of color range, but many of them are just bursting with color. I thought it was all just large expanses of snow.
Well, you see, you're revealing your art director roots there, Leonard. It is, in fact, vibrant with color, but a very specific spectrum of colors. Without getting too technical, but, you know, colors are defined by red, green, and blue, as you know. And water only holds green and blue. The red value is eliminated by H2O. Which is why if you put your hand in a pool, it looks very white, or you look dead if you look underwater, etc. So ice, when it's undergone a tremendous amount of pressure, especially in the glacier areas and generally the icebergs which come from them, these have a sort of an ancient life. They may be thousands of years old. And so over the course of that extraordinary pressure that presses these this ice away from the glacier, it squeezes the air out of the ice, because ice traditionally is air and H2O. But without the air, it eliminates that red value and now essentially emphasizes the green and the blue.
What about the plants? No red in any of the plants?
No, well, the plants, of course, that would be a summer, those were the summer periods. And you have all types of flowers in the Arctic, actually, that pop up. I mean, you know, indigenous flowers, of course.
And, of course, sunlight is a major issue there. The plants get a lot of sunlight in the summertime and none in the winter.
That's right. Yep. You're right. I mean, starting from about March 3rd, the sun doesn't set anymore at the North Pole. And that goes, of course, all the way to the solstice time, and then eventually gets to September when it no longer rises above the ocean.
And you go there both kinds of times? What's it like to be living in 24-hour light?
It's, well, if you're traveling, which I generally do, I'm involved in long expeditions. So you have the freedom of turning the clock, you know, essentially you're not, your travel is not dictated by daylight. But there is a change in temperature, of course. The sun has an incidence on local temperature, and it's colder in the, you know, nighttime when the sun gets lower to the horizon, even while it's not setting.
What role does the Arctic play in global climate trends?
Well, that's the critical question, of course. You know, in my field, you say that if you want to know what's going on globally in the next 30 years, you need to look no further than the poles. because that's the, you know, the early indicators.
Well, the North Pole has shifted throughout the history of the planet. Has that indicated what was happening below?
Well, nothing communicates warming climates sooner or faster than melting ice. You may have very minute shifts in temperatures globally in the low latitudes, and it's almost, you know, imperceptible. But in an ice environment, you see that immediately. In a snow environment, in mountaintops and whatnot, ski resorts, all of that stuff, you get a direct incidence and a change, very minute changes in the climate.
It was my sense that that was a pretty stable environment, but now it seems to be rather fragile.
Well, it's certainly nothing could be less stable than the polar regions at the moment, and in very different ways. You know, people often bundle up Antarctica and the Arctic, and I've spent a lot of time in both places. These respond in very, very different ways, but nonetheless, it is a systemic problem, so they do have incredibly powerful changes occurring there. I mean, just to simplify it, the Arctic is an ocean surrounded by continents, whereas the Antarctic is a continent of high elevation at that, surrounded by oceans. So by definition, there's the reaction to warming climate is going to be very different in these two environments. For the polar region, the northern polar region, the Arctic as it is, it's, you know, for the most part, you have the tundra and the five countries that surround it. And the Arctic Ocean itself is a thin crust of ice that can be anywhere from a few feet to a few inches, and or 0 inches for that matter, just open water.
Why is methane released when the ice sheet melts?
Well, that's the your point. You know, of course, one of the two greatest concerns, and many of the scientists' greatest concern, because over the course of time, the ocean has risen and ebbed and flow essentially according to temperature. As it freezes, the volume of the water lowers. As it melts, it increases. And during that time, when the ocean level has gone, 300 feet below where it is presently. In fact, this is how the early settlers came from Asia and crossed the Bering Strait on foot and then settled through North America and walked all the way down to South America. The Bering Strait was completely exposed at the time. Well, that whole region, especially in Siberia, were in warmer climes, had lots of forest and peat and all types of different organic matter that when it froze, all of that carbon got trapped into the ground that got covered with ice and never got to be released. And so as the ice thaws, all of that carbon in the form of methane primarily is being released, and it stores enormous amounts of carbon.
Well, we hear that methane causes global warming. So is this something where the melting is actually exacerbating the process?
Absolutely. I mean, that is fundamentally what the problem is that it is essentially it is a feedback that keeps perpetuating itself at exponential rates, because methane is a gas that is much more potent than CO2 or traditional greenhouse gases, and especially in the first 25 years of its release. So it has a very, very powerful incidence on global climate.
I'm speaking with Sebastian Copeland, whose latest book is Arctica, The Vanishing North, with a foreword by Sir Richard Branson, published by Tenoys. A huge book. How large is this?
I'm not sure, but it is.
It looks like 24, something like 18 by 24. It's a very large book. And
I do better on climate questions than the actual inch size of the book, but it is a doorstopper, yeah.
Well, the reason I ask is because would these photos have as much impact if they were smaller?
You know, I'm glad you bring this up. Actually, the publisher had recommended going in that format, and I was a little reticent. My last book was a horizontal format, and in the end, I have to say that he was right, and I'm very happy with being able to convey more viscerally the actual relationship with those magnificent environments.
And my listeners can see an image on our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. You include many photos of different wildlife in your book, not just polar bears.
Well, there is a very vibrant ecosystem there. I mean, when I say vibrant, it's for its sort of indigenous conditions. There's indigenous life there that you find nowhere else. Of course, polar bears is one of them. Bears, interesting.
Are they dangerous for humans?
Oh, they're deadly, of course, yeah.
Would they attack you just the way a grizzly might?
Very much so. I mean, in fact, much more so than a grizzly, because a grizzly is omnivore, whereas a polar bear is purely carnivore, and on top of that, it's seasonably feeding, not by choice but by necessity. So its one purpose in life is to fatten up, to make up for the lean months in the summer period when the sea ice melts, and that's its favored hunting grounds for seals, of course, who are mammals themselves and cultivate breathing holes through the ice. And the polar bears find themselves, in a melting season that is extending. In fact, it's about a month longer than it has been, than it was 30 years ago. And they shed up to 40% of their body weight. So a bear seeing protein of any form, including human, will absolutely go for it.
Is that the greatest danger?
It is the most obvious danger. I mean, the greatest danger could be said to be the elements themselves.
Could you fall through the ice as you might on a frozen lake?
You very much will, and if you travel to the North Pole, there is a very, very high likelihood that it'll happen. I mean, on my
That's why I'm not traveling there.
I did a trip in 2009 to the North Pole and fell clean through the ice to my neck in 35 degree below weather. So interestingly, the water was much warmer than the outside elements, because its freezing point is at 2.3 degrees C, and the outside temperature was 35 below.
Was that when you were commemorating Admiral Perry's 1909 expedition by walking hundreds of miles to the geographic North Pole?
That's right. Yeah, 1909 was the alleged time when Admiral Perry and Hansen and his team of Inuit, again, allegedly reached the North Pole, or at least close to it, because there's no actual verification, and it has been under question. But there's a very high likelihood that he was the farthest north in 1909. Interestingly, no one until 1968 reached the North Pole after him.
Well, how do you sleep? You carry around your own tent, I imagine. But how do you know whether the ice that you're lying on is going to support you throughout the night?
It's a good question. There's always movement. You're essentially on
you feel it moving.
Oh yeah. I mean, there are times when you hear it. It's just got its very unique cracking sounds, and you feel the motion beneath you. And there have been instances, not mine, luckily, but experiences where the ice literally has broken below the tent.
And when do you encounter other people?
Well, generally, you never do. I mean, this is, you're alone within millions of square miles.
So you never sleep in an igloo?
That's the attraction. No, I have slept in an igloo, but you wouldn't make an igloo. It's too time-consuming. And besides, that's the advantage of modern technology and the tents that we use today.
What do you do when you feel the ice breaking beneath the tent? Run?
I would definitely think of packing very rapidly and moving, you know. But all joke aside, I mean, the North Pole has a very, very high incidence. Ice in general has a very high incidence on our safety, our stability, both in terms of social construct and relationships to stability, but also, of course, with natural resources. I mean, the Antarctic, and now it's proven with Greenland as well, is seeing an increase in its meltwater coming from glaciers. And in fact, a lot of it is happening below the ocean level. And that has an incidence on just food production. If you picture that the Mekong Delta produces 50% of the global rice production and sits literally about, a foot and a half above sea level. Well, if you remove 50% of food production with an exponentially growing human demographic globally, you start to understand how these are going to be serious, serious problem that we're facing for the future.
And people are predicting that parts of all of the East Coast of the United States will be underwater, much of New York City. A lot of Florida as well, even though the governor of Florida denies that there is such a thing as global warming. What challenges does a photographer face when he or she is shooting in the Arctic that might not be apparent. Does the camera freeze up?
The camera actually is fairly resilient in this environment, so they handle the cold, you know, rather well. I mean, certain types of cameras, anyhow.
A Hasselblad, I imagine.
It's actually I use Canon, so and the Canons are very handy, very sturdy, and very very hearty for the cold weather.
Now, what about the sunlight? You have. You're shooting sometimes in constant sunlight, but is that good sun to shoot in?
Well, the photographer's, you know, nirvana is what they call magic hour, and that's when generally when the sun is low on the horizon, because it creates a warmer tone and sort of naturally pleasing shadows and whatnot. So the advantage of traveling in regions of very high or low latitudes, north or south, is that the sun generally doesn't rise above 30 degrees from the horizon. So you have really long magic hours. Sometimes they can last, 8 or 9 hours at a time. So,
one of the surprising things is you write that there can be wildfires in the Arctic.
That is especially true, of course, for Alaska. A lot of these pine forests that are around the Arctic Circle, because there isn't a lot of high vegetation in the Arctic, essentially because of the light, the lack of light and the photosynthesis and the ability of light to produce life.
But they're sending even more carbon into the atmosphere.
They certainly are. Well, I mean, one of the problems is that it gets drier and drier, less precipitation, less freezing cycles, and so a drier, essentially drier organic matter. And so when exposed to lightning or, you know, any other incidences of creating fire, these can spread and do spread at, destroying enormous amount of landscape and creating massive output of carbon into the atmosphere.
You think that people will start moving inland into Greenland, because pretty much all of the people who live on Greenland live along the coastline. The center area was largely ice sheet. With that changing, will that open up anything?
Well,
is there anything positive coming out of all of this, other than there may be a Northwest Passage now?
Look, I think one of the problems for local communities is, of course, how the coastal areas are being affected by water. So, there's a relocation of villages that's already taken place, mostly in Alaska and in that region. Alaska, which sees some of the areas in Alaska seeing up to 7 times the rise in temperature, compared to global averages. So these are local problems, and they're certainly worth considering. But I think the biggest story is the global impact of the Arctic or Antarctica on our societies. And, you mentioned earlier relocating in Florida and New York, and I want to just focus once again just on global calories being affected by this incidence of rising ocean levels, because you can always relocate. It's going to be costly and it's going to be inconvenient.
We'll all be living in Wisconsin.
But we still have Wisconsin. What we won't have for areas that depend on food production is the ability to sustain themselves. And with that will come an increase in refugee culture, because the climate refugee culture is ultimately the 21st century's big crisis. And a lot of it is going to be related to calories. I mean, with each degree of rise, we lose about 10% of global calories. And of course, it affects the hydrology of the planet as well. So,
are you going back soon?
I am, in fact. I just came back. I was there last week. I just spent 2 weeks on the Arctic Sea last week in training for another mission that I'm conducting to the North Pole next year.
But before that, Sebastian Copeland will be giving a talk at the Strand Bookstore on Broadway at 12th Street tonight at 7 o'clock as part of an Earth Day panel. He'll also be signing books, and the books are called Arctica, The Vanishing North, published by Tenues. That's Tenues. And if you want to get a sense of what we've been talking about, you can find some images on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate Sebastian, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you very much, Leonard. It's a pleasure.